Our first case set for this morning is State of Nevada versus Cardenas, 67225. Counselor present. If you wish to reserve time, Mr. Owens, please state as you begin your argument this morning. And for the record, please make the representation.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the appellant in this case, the State of Nevada. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We are here today on this appeal from the granting of a successive and untimely habeas petition following a guilty plea to two counts of lewdness with a minor. The guilty plea was entered almost 15 years ago. We're now faced with the prospect of investigating for the first time and preparing for a trial with a victim who was 12 years old at the time, who's now 27 years old. So we believe we're immensely prejudiced by the delay in these proceedings. The judge below found that there was good cause to entertain and eventually grant this habeas petition. The basis for the judge's finding of good cause is a little unclear. If you look at the findings that were prepared by opposing counsel, the findings don't really give any indication of what the judge was thinking. The findings simply say that the judge previously on another date found that there was good cause to overcome all three of the state's bars, the one-year time bar, successive petition bar, and the five-year latches bar. So you have to go look at the transcripts. And the judge did give us on several dates some articulation of why he believed that there was good cause. And it all centers upon the fact that the defendant was continually trying to withdraw his plea during the entire time that this case has been pending, that there was continually some proceeding pending somewhere where the defendant was actively, diligently trying to pursue some sort of relief.
Mr. Owens, I was trying to figure out what happened, kind of this long history here. Now, Greg Deneau was appointed his appellate counsel, I understand, at one time, but he didn't want Mr. Deneau, so there was some sort of lapse of time where Mr. Deneau was going to stay in or not stay in, trying to determine who had standing to do it. What other reasons do you feel were not good cause as far as this delay and him seeking this relief? You know?
Well, just because the defendant may be diligently pursuing relief, he was doing so in the wrong manner, really. That's up to him. He decided to go to federal court when he should not have. He should have filed his successive petition as he was instructed by this court in the denial of his first state habeas petition. This court instructed him that, hey, this is without prejudice to your right to file a successive petition. You still have to comply with the procedural bars and show good cause for it. But he did because during his first petition, Greg Deneau had not completed the appeal yet. So the claims of ineffective assistance of direct appeal counsel weren't even ripe, and that would have been good cause for him to file a successive petition. He ignored this court's instructions and went to federal court. That's why I believe under the judge's rulings in this case, this is a straightforward application of the Coley case. Pursuit of federal remedies is not good cause to overcome the state procedural bars. And that's where the bulk of the delay takes place, is in federal court, while the defendant's litigating his remedies over there instead of coming over here in the state court immediately and filing. So we have a lot of cases that fall into this same procedure of them going to federal court and kicking it around for 4 or 5 years before they come back with claims that they knew about before they even went to federal court. So that's what the judge's findings were, this continual diligence in pursuing relief, and that's just not good cause under Coley as a matter of law. Opposing counsel in their petition and in their brief to this court are advancing a different ground for good cause that the judge did not make any findings for, and that is that there was some sort of confusion on the defendant's part because of the procedural posture of this case and the various appeals and habeas matters.
Was that raised at all in district court in this case?
I believe it was raised by opposing counsel in their petition. The judge just didn't make any statements or articulations about that either on the transcript or in the written findings that opposing counsel drafted.
So the record's a cipher as far as what did the district judge think about that?
Right. The judge didn't say anything about confusion or that the state either the prosecutor or the lower court, the district, state district court or the federal district court, that they were somehow the cause of that confusion. The judge did not make any finding in agreement with opposing counsel's argument on that. And I would, even though it was not, you know, found by the district court below, in addressing that good cause here in my brief on appeal, I pointed out that if there was confusion about the status of defendant's direct appeal, that was a confusion of the defendant's own making. NRS 34 puts the burden on the defendant in his habeas petition to articulate the procedural history in his case. The state doesn't bear some sort of burden to correct the defendant to go research the defendant's own case. So the defendant represented to us and to the district court judge below that he had been denied his appointment of counsel on his direct appeal, and so we responded to those claims. To the extent that there was any confusion about that, this court cleared that up on appeal in denying his first state habeas petition, affirmed the denial of it, and said, hey, your appeal is pending, and you have Greg Deneau that represents you. And he knew that Greg Deneau was representing him on appeal. He just didn't want Greg Deneau. He even filed a pro per motion in his direct appeal to try to get Greg Deneau off his appeal, and this court said no, you get to keep Greg Deneau. And all these documents were filed or served on the defendant in prison, in proper person.
And was he trying to represent himself at that point, fire Mr. Deneau and handle this, these proceedings himself, or was he, I couldn't tell, was he trying to get another attorney, or what was
Well, he represented himself in his first state habeas petition and on appeal from the first state habeas petition, and that's where this court told him that you have a direct appeal and Greg Deneau is representing you on it. In fact, it's pending right now. And then in the direct appeal itself is where he filed, even though he's represented by Deneau, he filed a pro per motion to withdraw Deneau. And this court said no. Deneau stays on the case, and they ordered Deneau to file the opening brief. That order was served on the defendant in prison. So, you know, the defendant, if there's confusion, he's ignoring orders from this court, which would have cured any confusion on his part. And he's persisting in his representation that he did not receive a direct appeal. Well, he should have known better. This court told him so. And so to the extent that he's trying to blame some of that confusion on the prosecutor or the district court judge, this court cleared that up. And so he was aware that he needed to file another habeas petition if he wanted to challenge the ineffectiveness of Greg Deneau in his appeal, or raise claims against the plea counsel, Jordan Savage, in a successive petition, in which case he would have had to have complied with the state bars. And so even in federal court, where they claim that the attorney general somehow misled them and the federal district court misled them, again, those two parties were just accepting the defendant's representations about the procedure in this case. They accept at face value what he's telling them, that he didn't have an appeal in state court.
In the Ninth Circuit, there's a case in 2011 on this. It's an unpublished order by the Ninth Circuit. Do they and they recite this whole history. Is there anything in that recitation that is incorrect?
No, I believe that is correct.
Okay.
In fact, I'd go back to 2009. That's where the federal public defender is appointed for the first time in this case in federal court. If there was any residual continuing confusion on the defendant's part that was in any way attributable to the state, it would have been cleared in 2009 when the federal public defender filed an opening brief, which we have in the appendix in this case, where they set forth in clear detail the history of this case, and they acknowledged that there was a direct appeal and that the defendant had claims now to raise against Greg Deneau. That was 2009.
Right, and if by some stretch of the imagination there still was confusion, by 2011 this order from the Ninth Circuit seems to me to dispel it.
Certainly. And yet, we don't have any allegations of good cause from 2009 or 2011 to the date when they finally get around to filing their successive petition in state court. So I think as a matter of law, there simply is no articulable good cause here that the judge below could have found or that this court could find.
Your position is even if he was confused or whatever, that's not a good cause.
Even if he was confused, a lot of inmates are confused. And so you have to say even if he was confused and it was attributable to the state, which I disagree with that, but you have to make those two assumptions. And even then, it only gets them up to like 2009. After that, the federal public defender certainly knew what was going on and continued to reside and stay in federal court litigating their claims for another 4 years before coming back here. And they've never offered any good cause. Maybe they will here today. I don't know. It's not in the briefs. Good cause for those 4 years that they spent in federal court.
And the petition underlying this case was filed on 2013, right?
Yes, May 2nd, 2013.
Yeah. So whatever confusion may have existed, let's credit that there existed confusion. Let's credit that the state was contributed to it for the sake of argument. By 2009, or certainly by 2011, that's gone, right?
That is correct.
Okay. That was
And that's where Coley comes into play. During that time, they're offering no good cause, and what are they doing during those years? They're litigating their claims in federal court, which is not a good cause under this court's jurisprudence. So my position is we don't even reach prejudice here, and I urge the court, if you agree with me, that as a matter of law that there's no good cause, there's no need for remand. This case can just be summarily reversed for lack of failure to allege good cause to account for the entire length of delay. The prejudice, whether or not the ineffective assistance of counsel claims are meritorious or not, he cannot prevail without an allegation of good cause, and so it ought to be cut off there. There never should have been an evidentiary hearing. So in some cases, we have taken the judge up on a writ of mandamus at that point, where they bypass the bars and start ordering an evidentiary hearing on the merits of the claims. We didn't hear, because we don't want to abuse that writ process, but we were still hopeful that after the evidentiary hearing, the judge would reconsider good cause and or deny the petition. But because ultimately granted the petition, found prejudice, and had already found good cause, we find ourselves here today. I can address prejudice. I might reserve that for my rebuttal argument, because I really don't think
it's necessary. Any short comment as to genetic markers?
To be honest, I don't agree with the court in allowing a cross appeal to go forward here. The denial of a petition for genetic marker analysis is independently appealable. They didn't file a notice of appeal specifically from that. If they did, it'd be a separate appeal. Instead, this court allowed them to raise that issue in a cross appeal, which would only be appropriate if part of the habeas petition had been denied. It was granted. The defendant got all the relief that he was looking for. But even on the merits of the genetic marker petition, it's my position that it's moot. Once the habeas petition was granted, the defendant was no longer in the position of being a post-conviction litigant seeking to overturn a judgment of conviction. He was now in the position of a pretrial detainee seeking to prepare for trial.
But if you prevail on your direct appeal, then that changes.
If I what?
If you prevail on your direct appeal, that changes.
They're certainly free to file another motion. In fact, they have filed another motion that was again denied as moot for that genetic marker analysis on the same basis that the court said here, and that is, so long as this habeas ruling stands, they can't avail themselves right of that petition and would need to file it under the pretrial discovery rules by the appointed trial counsel, which is now appointed. I'm out of time, so I'll reserve the rest.
We'll give you a full 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amelia Bizarro, and I represent Mr. Cardenas in this case. This case is not about the fact that the case languished in federal court. That's not what Mr. Cardenas has ever argued as good cause. What he has said is that along the way, the state has misrepresented the record both in state and federal court, and that has caused the delay. They cannot now complain of prejudice from that delay, which they contributed to. This court evaluates the lower court's finding of good cause and has said that it generally will not disturb such a finding unless there's a clear case of abuse. And this case does not qualify as a clear case of abuse. By my count, there were 9 external impediments to the defense to be able to comply with the procedural bar. And this is only about timeliness. This is not about a successive petition.
As to the impediments and such, I guess one of the underlying concerns we have is that it still didn't deal with the total time period of delay. So if you can address that.
Well, I think underlying the court's decision that good cause was found incorporates this idea of the external impediments and the misrepresentations to the court. The federal public defender was appointed in the Ninth Circuit for the first time, and as the court pointed out there, the Ninth Circuit reversed and it remanded in an unpublished decision, and the court order there was to amend the petition in the federal district court, which we did. As part of that litigation, the state moved to dismiss the petition, and Mr. Cardenas sought as an alternative relief the option to go back to state court and litigate the case. So he has been pursuing the case all along, and if the impediments that first sort of slowed down the case hadn't existed, he would have been timely, both in state court, in an original state post-conviction petition. And the reason that I say that is because the of our nine impediments, the first one comes from Mr. Deneau. And when Mr. Cardenas files a state post-conviction petition in 2003, he doesn't believe that he has an attorney. All of his claims are related to the fact that he was never appointed an attorney and he asked for one. And the state there tells the court that he asked to represent himself and he cannot now complain of his own ineffectiveness. But what had happened was that he was given permission to represent himself at sentencing, which he did with standby counsel. And at the sentencing hearing, he said, I would like standby counsel to pursue an appeal. I wish to appeal. And the court instead appointed Mr. Deneau. But that there was never a written order alerting Mr. Deneau that he had been appointed. And Mr. Deneau never got in touch with Mr. Cardenas and never filed a notice of appeal. And this court had to threaten him with sanctions twice before he even filed a brief. And Mr. Deneau sent a letter to this court before that saying that I don't think that I'm appointed. So I think Mr. Cardenas' confusion there about whether he had an attorney and whether he's represented on appeal, it's justified. And it wasn't that he was lying to the court about not having an attorney or not having a direct appeal. I think he genuinely didn't know. The court adopted in the 2003 state post-conviction petition, the state's representation that he wanted to represent himself and that he was representing himself on appeal. And that's the second impediment. The third one in my mind centers on the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel with Mr. Deneau, who, as I mentioned before, had to be threatened with sanctions before filing a brief in this court. And that brief was 5 pages long. It was essentially a prior motion to withdraw the plea that he had filed, and he didn't file a reply brief. So at this point for Mr. Cardenas, he doesn't know that he's had a direct appeal. He's never received any information about his direct appeal. And he went to state post-conviction court and they said, no relief here. And to him, I think the only alternative was to go to federal court. And that's what he did. And he filed his petition there. Now the state is represented by the AG's office. And we have three more misrepresentations to the court. First, that all of Mr. Cardenas' claims are exhausted when they are not. Next, that Mr. Cardenas never filed a direct appeal. And third, that there's no merit to his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim because Mr. Cardenas fired his attorney and opted to represent himself. This is sort of continuation of the state post-conviction misrepresentation. While in federal court, Mr. Cardenas wrote to the federal court and alerted them to the fact that maybe I do need to go back to state court to exhaust these claims. Here, and this is impediment number 7, the state objected to that request, called it inappropriate, and noted that the court hadn't found that any claims had been ruled unexhausted. The 8th impediment is when the federal court adopted that representation and said the exact same thing that the state had said. Finally, the federal court denies the 22-4 petition, the federal court petition, and it adopts all of these misrepresentations, that he didn't have a direct appeal, that his claims were exhausted, that he couldn't have an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim because he wanted to represent himself. Well, all of that goes to the good cause, and I think that's why.
But wait one second here. Even if, I mean, what you're talking about would be a tolling kind of concept. equitable tolling, and I'm not disputing, I'm crediting that you're saying he was confused, and I understand. I think that's probably right. But it would toll, it wouldn't wholly excuse forever the timely filing. So in 2004 or 5, this court enters an opinion that makes quite, or order that makes quite clear that he had counsel on his direct appeal. And then time passes and he's in federal court in 2009 and in the Ninth Circuit in 2011. And both of those courts pretty much make it clear too. Yet there's nothing filed in state court until 2013. And he had a year to do it. So even if I credit everything, explain to me how he gets past the 1 year
the time bar. Yes, Your Honor. First, I think that it has to go, if it starts at all, it starts, I think, with the Ninth Circuit decision. So I don't think 2009 to 2011 really counts.
Or 2004 or 5, whatever the date was, I don't have it.
And I take your point, but I think for me that the problem is that without this confusion or these misrepresentations along the way, he could have gotten into court on time. And by misrepresenting facts to the court that the courts then relied on, he was prevented from doing that. And so I don't think it's so much what happened in 2011, but what happened when Mr. Cardenas was first trying to litigate his case.
But counsel, even if you've navigated through this prior time, but we have an order from the federal court in July of 2011. We have a two-year period thereafter. How do we deal with that delay? Because then it seems it was laid out where everything was, and then he didn't do anything for this other period of time.
I think for me that time is still attributed to the original state impediments that were launched in the beginning of the case. I mean, certainly the Ninth Circuit order in 2011 returns the case to the federal district court where he's ordered to amend his petition, and Mr. Cardenas is following that court order by doing that. In the litigation in federal court, I think there was some dispute over whether he could return to the state court at all or whether it could be litigated in federal court without having to come back to the state court. And so
nothing impeded him from filing in state court. I just hear you say that after the Ninth Circuit returned its case to district court in 2011, he was impeded from filing something in state court?
No. That's not what I meant. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, I misheard you then.
I think that the original impediments can't be ignored and cut off in 2011. And the idea being that, well, he could still have gotten into court by 2013, because I think that it still wasn't clear based on the remand to the federal district court and the litigation that was going on there. And I think because without these impediments at the beginning, we don't get to this point, but that's what causes all of this to flow from it. And because it flows from state misrepresentations, all of it is covered and the good cause finding must stand. It's not a clear case of abuse.
The court do you have any cases that support that approach to good cause calculation?
I would be happy to submit authorities. I don't have them at my fingertips.
Yes, okay.
The court had a two-day evidentiary hearing, and I think part of leading up to the evidentiary hearing was an examination of the unique facts that exist in this case. And he heard testimony from quite a few people and ultimately made a finding that trial counsel was ineffective. And I think that also is a finding that must stand. The trial court determined that trial counsel was both deficient and that it prejudiced Mr. Cardenas. Counsel met Mr. Cardenas for the first time 8 days before Mr. Cardenas signed a plea agreement. But at that original meeting and at one meeting before that with a different attorney, Mr. Cardenas alerted his attorney to his innocence. He identified two witnesses who would support his claim, and he noted that his DNA would not exist. And so this is also a case where we have existing evidence in the Las Vegas Police Department's possession that has not yet been tested that could be totally dispositive as
a let's take the good cause issue. Let's say the state were to prevail on its good cause appeal.
Okay.
Mr. Cardenas has the right to have genetic testing. I don't know that it would come up on cross appeal. If we credit his argument, then I'm not sure there's much left of your cross appeal because it reforms back, and I think he concedes you would have the right to pursue that. Why should we go ahead to the state's findings? I don't see that they're appealing so much those findings as they are appealing the good cause issue.
In that case, then I agree, Your Honor. If the court finds that it affirms the good cause ruling, then I think it necessarily affirms the finding of ineffective assistance. Conversely, I think what you're saying is if we disturb this good cause finding and we reverse, then what happens next? And in my mind, the DNA motion.
That is what I was trying to say.
The cross appeal, it's no longer moot. And I think that's what the reply brief sort of argues. Yes, it is moot as we sit here today because that order granting the petition exists. But should this court disturb that, then he should be allowed, and this court should order the DNA testing because he has met the test under the state statute that provides.
Would we be in a position to order that or is that something that you would need to repair to district court to secure in the first instance?
I think that this court could order because it was litigated before through Mr. Cardenas certainly filed briefs and demonstrated, and I think the test is relatively clear that this court could evaluate it. The reasonable probability that he wouldn't have been convicted or charged, the existence of the evidence with the Las Vegas Police Department has filed an inventory and says that we do have some evidence, and finally that the evidence has never been tested before. So I think given the test and the litigation that was already occurred, this court could rule on the DNA motion and order it to be.
What say you to his point that it is something that could be independently appealed? I read your cross appeal to be a protective cross appeal and understood it in that context. So what do you say to his point that it's not properly here and he disagrees with the prior, I guess it would be law of the case in this appeal that it's properly before us?
I think it was properly appealed and this court found as much when it allowed it to go forward. And so I think that that order stands. I do agree that it was a protective cross appeal. And I think that Attorney Norwood's pleadings made that clear that it was unclear what to do because the two things were litigated at the same time, but they are independent. So right. In my mind, I guess, whether this court rules on the DNA motion and says, you know, orders DNA testing or permits the issue to be heard, I think either way, this DNA testing gets done because the test is met here. In sum, I would say that the good cause finding is not a clear case of abuse. The unique circumstances of this case demonstrate that there were several external impediments to the defense. And the court, after a two-day evidentiary hearing where it carefully considered the evidence, made findings that trial counsel was ineffective, and that ruling should stand. Accordingly, I ask the court to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Mr. Owens, you have 3 full minutes.
Thank you. I disagree that this court can reach the merits of the genetic marker petition. The court below didn't reach the merits, didn't deny it on the merits. The court below said that it was moot because the defendant was no longer seeking to overturn a conviction. I don't even think this court should remand it. But to remand it, you'd have to find that it was error to deny it as moot. And I think that was a correct a legal ruling of mootness. At most, this court, if it were to grant my appeal, could simply do so and make a footnote that this is without prejudice to the defendant filing another motion. There's no bar to filing another motion for genetic marker analysis. And then the circumstances would change, and he would still be under a judgment of conviction, and he would now meet the criteria for that statute. The judge could
no longer. And there's no timeliness issue with respect to that.
It's been a while since I've looked at that statute, but I think that two-year bar is waived if they can seek, there's a standard they need to meet on the merits, but if they get the favorable DNA, it waives the two-year time bar, which they were way outside of before anyway. So I think their remedy is to, if my appeal is granted, for them to file yet another. It'll be their third.
Are you saying then that that would be a timely filing? Are you conceding that?
Again, I haven't looked at the statute.
Okay.
I didn't think there was any restraint, any problems in the statute, any time frame in which they need to file the petition for genetic marker analysis. There's a two-year limit, but not on them seeking to get the DNA material. And if the DNA is favorable, then that two-year thing is waived.
I knew there was a two-year limit on it, but I didn't understand that.
That's my understanding of it. So I don't think there's any prejudice. It would not be their third petition. I think that's the appropriate way for them to handle that if they want a ruling on the merits, and should this court grant my appeal. And just going back to the habeas petition, there's a big difference between them seeking stay in abeyance in federal court and going through that process to get authority from the federal court to come back to state court. That's a procedure that's necessary in federal court. It is not part of the requirements that Nevada has for returning to state court. There's no impediments. The defendant can file a petition any time, and many of them often do. In fact, the federal public defender has returned to state court prior to obtaining a stay in abeyance order. And in fact, even when their stay in abeyance was denied, they have still filed and returned to state court. So they picked the timing of that, and they knew in 2009, in their opening brief, they set forth the correct procedural history. They knew that there had been some confusion in the record. They knew he had a direct appeal. They knew that they had not raised ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. That's why they were allowed to amend their petition to add that claim in, and that's what made it no longer exhausted. And so they could have returned in 2009. So I've said everything I want to say on the case. Thank you for your attention to this.
Thank you. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments this morning, clarifying points they feel necessary and further education of the court. With that, this matter stands.